Hi there. Thanks for joining us. This is Space Nuts. My name is Andrew Dunkley, your host. It's really good to have your company. On this episode, we're going to be looking into a new report that suggests that things happened on Mars a long time ago that have added more evidence to the possibility that it could have harbored life, or at least started to make progress towards having some form of life. And it involves a chemical, I suppose, that you know and probably don't love. We're also going to be looking at the smallest exoplanet ever found. Will it retain that title for long? The word is possibly not. We'll explain why very soon on this episode of Space Nuts.
15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 10, 9, ignition sequence start.
Space Nuts.
5, 4, 3, 2.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Space Nuts.
Astronauts report it feels good.
And joining us to talk about all of that and much, much more is Professor Fred Watson, astronomer at large. Hello, Fred.
Hello, Andrew. Yes, still at large. Everybody thinks it's a joke title, but it's actually the name of my job.
Yeah, it is. Yes. Well, you used to be an astronomer in charge, but there was no one to be in charge of after a while.
So well,
had to redesignate you.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, it happens. It happens. So how you been? I mean, to the unwary, we've been together every week for the last several weeks, but I've actually just come back from Egypt. So
you have, and I'm very anxious to hear how it went.
Well, I'll start with the bad news. I think I caught COVID.
Yeah.
So I spent most of that trip actually under the weather. But on top of that, what a fascinating place. What incredible history. And I don't know what to tell you was the best thing I saw. The pyramids and the Sphinx go without saying. The Valley of the Kings was extraordinary, getting down into the tombs in the Valley of the Kings and seeing the elaborate artwork and the hieroglyphics and the and some of the things that they did to try and trick the grave robbers. Like little sand traps and wells and false sarcophagus and false walls and just so many amazing things that they did to ward off the looters. The Civilization Museum was an eye-opener for me because that's where the mummies are. There's only actually one mummy that's remained in the Valley of the Kings. Do you know which one it was?
I don't know.
It's Tutankhamun,
okay,
is the way they pronounce it. Yeah, yeah. He's still there because his body is too delicate to move around. The rest of them are in a museum in Cairo called the Civilization Museum. Highly recommend that because you can actually go down under the main exhibition floor and walk from one chamber to another and get up close and personal with the pharaohs. And they're all there. They're all there. All the Rameseses, there's a whole bunch of them, including the famous Rameses II, and just so many. Real eye-opener. Luxor, I really liked Luxor and the temples. I'm pretty well templed out. I don't know how many we went to. But gee, we saw a lot. But they're all part of the story,
yes.
And that's what it was about, to try and piece together this amazing history. We even went to a granite quarry where they mined pink granite to create those famous obelisks.
And is that the one where there's an obelisk that's still half finished?
Yeah, and it split. It broke. So it's still lying down in...
Lying down, yes.
In the ground, not completely cut out of the ground. So they'd given up that project. But can I show you something? Hang on a sec. Wherever I go, if there's a rock worth collecting, I get one. So that is a piece of pink granite from the ancient granite quarry in Luxor.
You've probably just broken the law by showing us that. You're going to get Space Nuts hold of the calls.
It's allegedly a piece of pink granite.
Allegedly, yeah.
But yeah, what an amazing place. And we did a river cruise on the Nile and spent 3 nights on the boat. And then we went to a Red Sea resort and hung out there. Someone said to me, I'll be really keen to see how you feel when you come back as to whether or not you really believe the Egyptians could have built the pyramids. That's not a nice question. I think Cairo surprised me. I didn't expect it to be quite as third world as it was. And yet, just up the road, they're building New Cairo, which is modern and dynamic, and there is an astronomical connection there, Fred, that you were telling
me about.
That's
right, yes. Of course, when we were there in 2018, part of our tour, which Marnie put in specially for me, was to visit a telescope that's actually quite close to my heart. It's a big telescope at a place called Kotamia, if I remember rightly. It's Helwan is the nearest place. It's 74-inch telescope, a large one, a classic of its time. But unfortunately, New Cairo is going to essentially brighten up its skies to the extent, because of light pollution, to the extent that it won't be viable anymore, which is a great shame because telescopes last a long time. This one was built in the 50s and it's still going strong.
Well, having seen what they've done, I was told 2 years ago it was nothing. It was just desert. And now you've got this mega city, 13-lane highways. It's just extraordinary what they've done. So, yes, I do believe that the Egyptians built the pyramids. not aliens. Definitely not aliens.
It wasn't aliens, no.
I know I've spent a bit too much time on this, but I'll just tell you a little bit about issues with language and translation. Had an incident where I was we were staying at a hotel and I asked for the Wi-Fi password, so they gave me a menu. I twice asked for white wine and got red wine. I once asked for coffee and got tea. And we asked one of our guides what the length of the Gaza Road was because, obviously we're interested in where Gaza was. And he said, that's the Gaza Road and it's 5,000 kilometres long. And I went,
oh, okay.
Yeah, maybe not, seeing Gaza was 350 kilometres away.
Yes.
And the other funny thing, we asked him the population of Cairo. And I think he knew, but he couldn't put it into the right words. So apparently there are 30,000 people living in Cairo.
Okay. Might be.
That was
a lot of that's language issues.
It was. Definitely. But an amazing trip, and we felt safe.
Good.
They're very careful over there and never really felt there were any issues or dangers. And they take security pretty seriously too. So, it was a good trip. Pity I got sick early and had to live with that all the way through. And now jet lag. So I'm sitting here with both at the moment. So apologies if I disappear and...
It's okay.
It's just mucus. Nothing to be scared of. Now, Fred, we've got a lot to do and I've burned a lot of time. So let's get into our first topic. And this has everything to do with Mars and its past and the possibility that it could have, at some stage in its history, harbored life. And a new paper has been published which adds a little bit more weight to that theory.
Yes, that's right. And it comes from Japan, Japanese researchers who've done some modelling of what Mars's ancient atmosphere might have been like. And what they've done, and by that I mean the period, I think it's called the Noachian period, if I remember, something like that. Anyway,
as against what is the Noachian period now?
Yes, that's right. When there was liquid water on the surface because the pressure was higher than it is now, the temperature was warmer than it is now, what we're talking about is a period. In fact, it is. It's that early period from about 3.8 to 3.6 billion years ago. And what these scientists have done is looked at the kind of gases that are coming out of volcanoes and what they contain. Basically, you've got things like hydrogen, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and water. And they've sort of envisaged that these chemicals would have been in Mars's early atmosphere. But what they've modeled is how they would change. And it turns out that because of solar radiation, the photons that come from the sun, you get chemical reactions. For example, carbon dioxide turns into carbon monoxide, water turns into hydrogen and oxygen. You put all these things together and you get formaldehyde, which is a very well-known chemical that we think of as a preservative for specimens in jars.
Did the Egyptians use formaldehyde?
I wouldn't be surprised. I think so. Yes, probably in mummification. Yes, yeah. That's right. When you take that modelling, yes, you get formaldehyde. You can probably then dissolve that in the the water oceans. But either way, the existence of formaldehyde basically means that you've got a sort of, and let's do the Egyptian thing again, a Rosetta Stone for some of the other molecules that could form from formaldehyde reacting with other chemicals to form carbon-rich molecules. Mm. The sorts of things that we think of associated with life, like amino acids and things of that sort. So this research, again, it's sort of, I suppose, leaning towards the optimistic side regarding life on Mars. One of the researchers, there's a lovely quote here, and I'm reading from SciTech Daily in this particular story. The researcher says, "Our research provides crucial insights into the chemical processes that may have occurred on ancient Mars, offering valuable clues to the possibility of past life on the planet." This is Shungo Koyama, and that's the lead author of the study. And so it's basically, it's broadening the research, broadening the level of possibilities that we have for the formation of what we would call biomolecules, the molecules that basically go into living organisms. Now, we're finding those all over the place. We find them on comets and even asteroids. But to find a reaction that can actually generate these chemicals on the surface of ancient Mars is, I think, a step forward. It's a very interesting piece of research. And once again, provides some optimism for people who are looking for, perhaps in the end, when we get the samples back from Perseverance, we might be looking for evidence of past living organisms, fossilized perhaps in the dust and soil of Mars.
Yes, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? And this just seems to add a little bit more fuel to the fire.
Yes, that's right. It does indeed, which is, it's an interesting step and a nice piece of research. I'm no chemist, but I admire people who can work out what these reactions are and tell you what comes out at the end.
Yeah, I suppose we should add a caveat and say they're basing this on a few assumptions.
Yes,
which sometimes
correct.
You have to do, so it's not an absolute, but the assumptions are fairly sound. And that is the existing conditions on Mars at the time. But we know in its history it probably had liquid oceans, it was warmer, and now this could add another little piece to the life puzzle. Will be astounding, and hopefully in the not-too-distant future we will have answers.
Yeah, the answers, or the nearest thing we'll get to answers will be when these samples come back from Perseverance, which I think it's laid a cache of something like, is it 17 samples left around on the surface of Mars? I know that the planning for the recovery mission for these is in trouble in terms of finances and things. This is meant to be a joint ESA NASA mission. I think it was originally scheduled for 2028. I think there's issues with that. I haven't followed up on them, but it looks as though people are raising questions about it. So we'll have to see how that goes. It is a very important mission, of course, to bring back for the first time samples of Martian soil.
Yeah, I still kind of shake my head about the fact that they created such a fabulous mission to collect the samples, but they put the collection idea on the back burner, and it's still on the back burner. So
I hope it won't stay there for very long.
Yeah, well, you know, those things have been up there for billions of years. They're not going to go away.
No, that's right.
I think, you know, we'll get around to it eventually. That's what people do.
That's what I do.
I'll get to those weeds in the garden.
There's a few things like that
eventually. All right, if you would like to read up on that story, as Fred suggested, the scitechdaily.com website is a great place to start. This is Space Nuts. Andrew Dunkley here with Professor Fred Watson. Let's take a short break from the show to tell you about our sponsor, NordVPN. Now, a virtual private network is a great way to protect yourself when you're online, particularly if you're using public Wi-Fi. I've told you that many times. But with Nord, there are so many other benefits. You're not just getting a virtual private network. You can get all sorts of other add-ons that are very beneficial. Of course, protecting your passwords is all important, and remembering them is a bit of a challenge these days with so many passwords for so many different tools and apps and everything else we use. And Nord can just remember all that for you, and you don't have to think about it anymore. Depending on which package you get, you might also like some of the other tools, like email masking service. Now, I haven't mentioned that before, but let's have a go. I'm logged into my NordVPN service right now. Click on email masking, and it basically gives you the option to hide your genuine identity online by using a mask. Yeah, every time a website asks for your email. I think that's remarkable. It's not a tool that I've actually used much, but I'll give it due consideration, because sometimes I want to read an article on a news website, but they won't let you read it until you sign up. That annoys me. It annoys me a lot. Same thing if I want to maybe look at a shopping website and ask them, make an inquiry. I don't like giving them my genuine email address or identifying myself, because I know what'll happen next. I'll get spammed to oblivion. So being able to shield yourself in terms of your identity from genuine websites, but also being able to hide yourself from data breaches, it also gives you great control over your inbox. So this is something I'm going to start using more and more. And it's a simple case of just clicking on the create email mask and away you go. And there's other great tools that Nord offer. The data breach scanner, which is an easy click-on tool. You just click on it and it will just automatically do a scan and let you know if there's any data breach in your system. And it does happen from time to time, and they will alert you. It basically means that your information has ended up on the dark web for some reason. Somebody sold your email address or some other element of your personal information. And the other thing that I like that I have taken advantage of is the emergency access. If something happens to you and your partner or wife or husband needs to access information on your Nord service, you can basically give them emergency access to your service so that they can get in there and find out passwords and information that they might need if you're incapacitated. Brilliant, simple, effective. Now, NordVPN has a special offer right now because, as a Space Nuts listener, they are going to give you a special deal. So go to the URL nordvpn.com/spacenuts, nordvpn.com/spacenuts, then click Get NordVPN. Or get the deal and look at all the options. 2-year option, 1-year option, monthly plan. You get an extra 4 months for free. You get 30-day money-back guarantee. And the more you
sort of buy over the longer period, the cheaper it gets. You can get everything or you can get bits and pieces of what you need. Just check it out for yourself. Look, it's a fabulous product, very handy, works on just about every device available to humankind these days, but a really great product, and NordVPN, the best in the business. So check it out today, nordvpn.com/spacenuts. Now, back to the show.
0G and I feel fine.
Space Nuts.
You are indeed with us, and we're grateful for that, so thank you. Now, it's time to look at things beyond our solar system, and a lot of the time they are exoplanets. And we have now discovered the smallest exoplanet ever found, Fred. This thing's, I suppose it's really tiny, but it's opened up that debate on, okay, is it a planet or is it something else?
Yeah, that's right. That's why it's in the news. It's just the question about whether this object, which actually has been known for about 10 years, I think, whether it is a planet. So what are we talking about? We're talking about an object called Kepler-37b, and it's an object that was discovered by the Kepler mission, and we should just recap on that. It's now, yep. Kepler is now not operating anymore, but that mission, which was incredibly successful, was to measure the brightness of stars very, very accurately and measure them over time. I think they did it 100,000 stars at once, if I remember rightly, and to look at the way the light from those stars varies and to detect when objects pass in front of those stars. So that means you have to have a planetary system around the star that's actually aligned with the direction back to Earth. And there's quite good statistics on you know, how many you might expect to find like that. But indeed, it was so many that many thousands, I think it was 3,000 or 4,000 planets were detected by Kepler as they passed in front of their parent star, caused a dip. Next time round, they passed in front of their parent star, caused another dip. Yep. And I think if you get the third one, that's when it is classified as a planet rather than being a suspected planet. So Kepler was really successful at this. And the reason why it sort of revolutionized the planet finding process was before Kepler, the main way of finding planets was the Doppler wobble method, where you're looking for wobbles in the motion of a star backwards and forwards, towards and away from you, that have been caused by a planet pulling the star slightly out of place. Now, that's a great way of finding big planets, but for little ones, it's pretty grim because the pull of a little planet is not very great on its parent star. Whereas the Kepler method, what's called the transit method, because the planet transits across the disk of the star, that is very sensitive to actually quite small planets. And just to spill the beans on how big we think it is, Kepler-37b is actually about the same size as the Moon, which is a quarter of the Earth's diameter. Now, that's the record breaker at the moment. But the question, I guess, that was raised was, is it really a planet? Is it an asteroid or something that's not spherical?
And that is something that we Earthlings have defined through the Astronomical Union, and it has to meet certain criteria to be defined a planet, which Pluto couldn't do anymore, and that's why it was redesignated in 2006.
That's correct, on, if I remember rightly, the 23rd of August. that was the date, I think, of the vote, which is still controversial, honestly.
Yeah.
My view, as you well know, is it was the right decision. So... Mm. The criteria, and this is the nub of this story, it's got to orbit a star or the sun, in the case of the solar system. It has to be big enough that this process called differentiation has pulled it into a spherical shape. In other words, its own gravity has overcome the resistance of the rock, which is probably molten back in the day when it was being formed. Its own gravity has overcome that resistance and pulled it into a sphere. But the third criterion, and this is the one that Pluto fails on, is that it's got to be the dominant object in its neighbourhood. It's got to have gravitationally cleared other objects out of the way.
Yeah.
And if it hasn't done, then it is a dwarf planet, which is why that new categorization was introduced, something that's spherical but hasn't become the dominant object. Mm. It's a dwarf planet. And indeed, Pluto isn't the dominant object. There are other things that are equal in size to Pluto, probably things that are bigger that we haven't found yet out there in the depths of the solar system. So that's the question in relation to Kepler-37b. Has it cleared its own area of the region around its parent star, which is called Kepler-37. And the answer is, it's really hard to know that because the stuff that will be around it will be very small. But I think the upshot of the research that is being described here, it's a scientist, and I can't remember, I think it's Thomas Barclay is the name, but I can't remember. Yes, Goddard Space Flight Center.
Yes.
Thomas Barclay, Goddard Space Flight Center. And in fact, he Thomas was the first author of the paper 11 years ago that actually identified that planet as being a planet, Kepler-37b. Mm. I think what has happened now is to look in more detail at the star itself. Because we can learn things about stars from a topic that we don't often talk about, Andrew, even though it's actually well pursued here in Australia. There's a very strong group at Sydney University that look at this topic. It's called astroseismology, and it's about vibrations in stars. You can even apply this to the sun. The sun's got I think they're about every 5 minutes, the sun wobbles slightly.
Yeah.
It's a natural oscillation, and you can see those in the brightness of the star. And I think they've made, just by looking at these oscillations, what they've done is got a better estimate of the diameter or the mass of Kepler-37b, essentially, it is what we said. It's about the size of the moon. And that's really the remaining place where we are at the moment. It's definitely that size. The likelihood is it's spherical because an object in the size of the moon, what is it, 2,500 kilometres or thereabouts? It's actually a bit more than that. It's getting on for three. Yes, it's over 3,000, 3,200 or something like that. That size, it will have become a sphere. It will have become spherical. The gravity is enough to pull it into that spherical shape. So the only really remaining question as to whether 37B qualifies as a planet is whether it's cleared the region around it.
Mm.
And the suspicion is, because it's so close to its parent star,
it only takes
13 days to go around once.
Yeah.
The likelihood is that stuff is long gone. I think, are still holding Kepler-37b up on a pedestal as the smallest planet known outside the solar system. And in fact, it is the smallest planet because it's actually smaller than Mercury. But we are looking forward to the launch in 3 years' time of the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, which is a kind of Hubble-like telescope that's going to do all sorts of interesting things because it's got a wide field of view. And that will be detecting exoplanets by a different method, not the transit method, but one that has actually found favour from astronomers on Earth, not just in space. It's called gravitational microlensing. And what happens is if a planet passes in front of the light of a star, its gravity changes the brightness of that star. This lensing process basically focuses the light. It's gravitational lensing is the phenomenon where space is distorted by a galaxy or a planet or something like the Earth. Space is distorted by that, and what you get is a lens in space, effectively a lens. and that can magnify the light of a distant star. Gravitational microlensing has been very successful in finding new exoplanets. Not as successful as the transit method, but if you've got a big telescope looking out for these things, you might discover thousands of exoplanets by this technique. And the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, if I remember rightly, it's about the same size as Hubble, is you know, on the trail of this. So in a few years' time, we might find another huge trawl of gravitationally microlensed planets, and maybe we will find one smaller than Kepler 37b.
In fact, I think they are anticipating that's a probability. Yeah. Because this method, they believe, is going to catch quite a big cluster of planets in the where are they going to look exactly? Anywhere they can.
Yeah, it's a really sensitive technique for small planets. I might just add that colleagues in New Zealand are actually particularly involved with this technique. There are various projects, all with quite entertaining names. I'm trying to remember one of them. I forgot what it is. Microfun. That's it. Microfun is one of them, which I like. Ogle is another. So colleagues in this part of the world are very active in that process, including some amateur astronomers as well.
Okay. If you would like to read about the confirmation that 37b, Kepler 37b, is the smallest exoplanet thus found, you can do that at space.com. Fred, we are done for another day, and I just remind people that you can go to our website, have a bit of a peruse, and get in touch with us there. And don't forget, if you're a YouTube follower and you watch us on YouTube, don't forget to hit that subscribe button down below.
Where is it again, Andrew? Where's that subscribe button?
Down below.
That's good.
Down there somewhere.
That's the one.
Fred, thanks so much. We're done for another day.
Sounds good. And I look forward to the next time, Andrew.
Indeed. Professor Fred Watson, astronomer at large, part of the team here at Space Nuts, the podcast. And thanks to Hugh in the studio, who's been basically sitting on his hands for the last few weeks because he's had nothing to do. That's different how? I'm not sure. Anyway, from me, Andrew Dunkley, thanks for your company. Catch you on the very next episode of Space Nuts. Bye-bye.
Space Nuts. You'll be listening to the Space Nuts podcast. Available at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or your favorite podcast player. You can also stream on demand at Bytes.com. This has been another quality podcast production from Bytes.com.